Hi everyone, it's Andrew P. Mayer here. Welcome back to the Active Design Podcast. This week was the week of E3. It's a show I used to go to quite a bit. I went there for the first 12 years, except for one of the years that it was in Atlanta, Georgia. But I did make it to one of those. It was a pretty depressing show, actually. But regardless of that, it's been an interesting year because once again, it's time for the console refresh. Nintendo jumped out of the gate early, securing their position as the Sega Dreamcast of this generation, being the platform that, while it might find a home somewhere and probably will sell better, to be honest with you, it's also out of the running as far as the press and most of the game fans are concerned. They tried to come out with something cool and new and discovered that one of the secrets behind the fact that the iPhone was a success was that the interface for the iPhone was flawless. A crappy touchscreen is the reason that we didn't get an iPhone-like device for the first half of the 21st decade of the 20th century, and making one now isn't any better. So with Nintendo safely out of the way, the battle falls to Sony and PlayStation, since Sega has long ago given up the ghost. In that battle, we saw Sony come out in February with what would best be described by me, at least, as a panic attack for the public. Without a price, without a design, with a fancy new controller, with social media features that didn't seem to have any point. And I understand why they're panicking. While the press is still excited and able to cover this as a horse race, because let's be honest, the horse race is the press's best story. At the same time, or always the easiest story to tell anyway. At the same time, year over year, the consoles have been losing power in the home, in a living room that I argue isn't as important as it used to be. So, Microsoft managed to put out a media show a few weeks ago that was more polished, more interesting, and more focused on the media playing features of its product than it was on the game-related features of its product. That all changed the morning of, I believe it was Monday morning, when Microsoft came out and showed us their games, told us about the exciting new technology that they had, and basically managed to, if not underwhelm us, at least confuse us effectively. That afternoon of the same day, Sony walked out onto their stage and pretty much blew everybody away. Not only coming out with a confident and well staged show, but one that actually talked about games that people were interested in, showed that they were building a tiered ecosystem for content development, and supported indie game developers in a way that Microsoft kind of hinted at by showing us a really, really high definition of a really, really low resolution game called Minecraft. Well, that was very exciting. But by the end of that day, it was pretty clear that the market that had already on Twitter shown an 85% to 15% approval rating for the Sony console wasn't only not mistaken, but were actually prescient. The press and the tide has turned pretty solidly against Microsoft. You can argue that Microsoft lost this on misinterpretation of their DRM and their resale, but you know, Sony is giving you something that they're not giving to, that Microsoft isn't giving you, and it's a big deal. You can say, look, we're gonna support the, so Sony's saying that they'll support what exists currently, which is that if somebody rebuys a piece of content, that the content developers are allowed to force some features to be available by the player having to buy those features. That's not the same with a code. And I mean, conceivably, it's possible that the developers could put a code in there that basically locks out all the content in the box, but that seems pretty unlikely because, look, at the end of the day, they want to sell stuff. And if you don't give the player anything, if you don't give them some kind of free-to-play experience or, you know, purchase-to-play experience, excuse me, then ultimately, you're going to end up giving them nothing. What Microsoft has done, just so we can clearly differentiate here, has actually given in-box features to stop players from using contents, basically locking, instead of saying you're opening the content by putting in a code, they're locking the content until a code is provided. Once the software has been registered to a specific machine, in order to be able to unlock it again, it has to be registered to a new machine. So, given that, and given some of the other features, given the fact that Sony is going to clearly position this as a gamer machine, and Microsoft is clearly positioning this as the center of the digital living room, what do I think? I think that neither of them is going to win. I think it's a fight over a battle that's been lost, and I think that over the next couple years, as the secondary platforms start coming online in a serious way, as we start seeing Apple, and we've already seen that this week, by the way, on Monday as well, which was a lot of news to deal with, let me tell you, with Apple announcing their stuff, Apple is building their ecosystem one piece at a time. You may never see the much vaunted Apple TV, but you know, I'm already someone who has an iPhone device, an Apple laptop, and an Apple TV, and I can tell you one of the joys of being within that ecosystem is the ease with which I can move content between all three devices. I can stream AVI files from my laptop through my iPad to my Apple TV. Why would I want to do that, you ask? Well, it's because some things are easier to get as AVI files, and they are not easy to play directly from my laptop without completely taking over the laptop and making it impossible to use the machine while I'm watching. Yes, I'm a second screen fan. Go figure. We're also going to see more of that. I mean, Apple is doing that. Microsoft is, you know, offering Glass as a way to do some of those features. You know, with all those limitations, with all those ways that we know what we want, but we aren't being allowed to have it, what that leaves room open for is a strong DRM ecosystem where you can have all the features you want on your PC, but the games are available from a centralized client. Who would that be? That would be Steam. Now, to say that Steam is going to end up being the winner in this generation is pretty tough. I mean, they don't have a Steam box yet. But I do think that overall, what's safe to say is that we've moved away from the era where we're rapidly moving away from the era where the hardware is important and to an era where the software is important. Now, I know that the iPhone is sort of puts lie to that idea, because when we get the iPhone, we have a nice, strong piece of hardware. But the thing is, at least until there's something new, until there's some new feature that isn't just waggling or the Kinect type features, something that feels like it fundamentally changes the experience of the machine that you're using it on in a way that is obviously improved by the software that runs it, it's hard to argue that the Kinect, and it's hard to argue that the Kinect is that, then I think what we're going to see is the software, is the hardware becoming more neutral. That we, you know, it's not what I'm running it on, it's what I'm running. The stage has been set for the next generation of computing. You know, Google Glass, all these other things can fight over those next generation processes, but, you know, I think it's been on almost an exhausting run, and at least for the next generation, not for all time, not forever, I do think that in 5 or 6 years we're going to have enough new pieces of new technology, things like the Leap, things like Luma Room, although God forbid that I have to, like, close my curtains during the day to use my interface, but, you know, elements that will change the experience of interface and software enough in the ways that they interact with the real world that will start to want to lean towards the platforms that implement that well, at least in the first generation. But for now, we're coming to the end of that. And the advantage that I think Steam has, or a Steam-like box, is that Steam has already proven that you can have the kind of DRM that Microsoft wants. You can have the kind of buy once, can't sell. But what Steam has done since the earliest days of their launch is say, once you've purchased it on the platform, once you own it on Steam, one, Steam will be everywhere you are. That Steam will be available. So, you know, I have a copy, I bought an original copy of Half-Life 2 way back in the 90s. And when Steam first started up, I logged that content into Steam. And I still now own that copy of Half-Life, the original Half-Life, you know, 16 years later, whatever it is, 15 years later. Now that's pretty impressive. And that's the kind of customer-focused, user-focused experience that for a platform that large, of that scale, is going to create loyal customers. Now look, Steam has some really big challenges ahead of it, not the least of which is that they want to move their primary platform to Linux. Linux isn't well adopted, it isn't as user-friendly in a lot of ways as Windows is, although Microsoft has done their best to make the Windows experience more hassle-full than hassle-free. And Apple is Apple if you don't understand and know how to use it and take the 3 to 6 months that it really takes to change over to the new system. You're not going to love it. But the truth is that if they can make that leap, and they can say, look, here's a reference box, here's our Steam box, or here's a Steam box standard, but what you'll get is all your software will not only run on it, but likely very rapidly a lot of the old software will run on it as well. I mean, you can see the other thing that Steam has done very well for the first time in the history of the industry is give you access to a back library of product. You know, television and movies, the old stuff is content that you can still sell. You can go out, I have a copy in my closet of the old Groucho Marx You Bet Your Life show from the 1950s because I was dating someone for a while who liked watching them on YouTube, and I could go back, find that content, and buy that content. Try to go back and buy an old game that runs on modern platforms. For a long time that was impossible. Now it's just difficult. Scattershot. But it's possible, and Steam is only going to improve. Now, of course, there'll be other challenges. Steam isn't going to be the only game in town forever. They aren't the only game in town forever. Sony has done a good job with putting streaming features on that Steam doesn't have. But the other advantage of the Steam Box, besides being a standard rather than a mandatory hardware system, is also that outside of the games ecosystem, you can use it for whatever the hell you want. You want to watch your Netflix? Watch it on the web. You want to watch Hulu? You don't need to have a Hulu subscription in order to watch Hulu on the web, and it will be a web experience. So, is Steam the winner? There's some negotiation that has to happen. There's some discussion that has to happen. There's a Steam box that has to come out. But laying back and letting the giants fight it out for this year, for a platform that will be coming out next year, and once it's out, the thing about the console platforms is they don't update. The Steam box can update anytime it wants. Your PC can update anytime it wants. Even your Google and your Android and your iPhone devices are updating at least once a year, right? So how long is it after the release of this box that's supposed to last, what, another 7 years until we see something new entirely? And it's hard to imagine. It's not hard to imagine this box selling for now, but there's a lot of assumptions, and I've written about this on the website. I'll put a link up. There's a lot of assumptions in this generation of consoles where they're trying to maintain the business model they had in the last generation of consoles. And that's all good and well, and they may be able to convince people to buy it now, but the idea of a box designed to go to that central big flat TV in your living room, no matter how many side sliding windows, no matter how many Skypes they make available, can we really imagine that by 7 years from now that people are going to really want that as their fundamental home experience in any way, or that the next box is in any way going to be a console like the previous one? It's going to be a wild ride. It's going to be interesting. It's not something that I think and that most people are going to design for. I think we'll still see the AAA titles coming out. We'll still see those big brands coming out. Those big cinematic $70 experiences will still be coming out for that box. But look at the indie games. They're not being developed for that platform. Sure, Sony's putting some money into some unique content, and indie developers are cheap. I don't think you have to wave nearly as much money under the nose of a starving indie guy to get him to develop an original content for your platform that you would. And look, the stars always get pulled up into the system. That's as true as having Kenneth Branagh and Joss Whedon directing, you know, big budget Marvel movies as it is having the guy who created Octodad show up on the stage of the Sony talk. But at the same time, where the real work is being done, where the real creativity is being done, is shifting away from that platform towards the independent developers who are looking to create products that will work on your iPhone, that will work on your PC, on your Windows, on your browser. on your Android device, wherever that may be. It's going to be interesting, and I'm going to keep an eye on it, and I'm going to talk about the design challenges of integrating business models, of integrating user experiences, of integrating user profiles into a model that not only has to live on different ecosystems, but has to really, in order to be a hit, or more importantly, in order to take advantage of that audience once it is a hit, to be able to integrate those experiences in a way that will allow you to monetize and will allow you to keep retain those users for the time you need to be successful with your product. All right, that's a rant. And now we are on to the interview portion of the show. Today I have Erica Mulkey. She is known as Unwoman. Erica's a musician. She's been a musician for quite a while. That's what she does for a living. But it's interesting to me because Erica came out of a background of development, of making ringtones for phones, for MIDI phones. She went to school for electronic music. I'll talk about this in the interview. But Erica is, you know, in her early 30s and is from a generation that grew up with technology, and the music that she creates, the way she creates music, which is beautiful, looping cello pieces, is so fundamentally integrated. And the way she sells that music through Kickstarter, of course there's the Jonathan Coltons of the world, there's the people who have made a ton of money on these Kickstarters, but Erica is a working musician and she works that through Kickstarters. As we'll talk about, she's run seven of them, and this is how she makes her living, and I'm really lucky, I'm excited to talk to her, and I think if you're interested in making software for the new platforms, that you'll find it really interesting too, or if you're just curious as to how the new platforms are making money, it's worth listening to. Okay, that's enough of me. Let's get on with the interview. Hi, I'm here with Erica Mulkey, also known as Unwoman. Erica is a singer, cellist, songwriter, in whatever order you would like. And she is... We're here at Clockwork Alchemy, which is a steampunk convention, because, as I probably mentioned way too many times, I'm a steampunk author. and Erica plays a lot of steampunk events. So what else do you want to tell people about who you are and what you do?
Well, I've been doing music full-time for a little over 3 years, and steampunk has been really good to me, so that's why I do these things.
So I wanted to explain to people why I've brought you onto a design-centered podcast.
Yeah.
And before I sort of run down that road, do you want to talk about your experience as design and a designer?
I've been releasing my own albums for 12 years, and I always do my own design, and sometimes it's better than other times. I come to it from a DIY perspective. I studied music in college and not visual design, but I still want to do my album covers because I feel like I have a decent aesthetic sense.
And so you've done all your own album covers, right, for all your albums?
Yeah. I mean, other people take the photos, but I'm, doing the costuming and everything, and I do all the layout.
And then in terms of, and then before you were doing music, we've talked about this before, but let's tell the world, you used to do ringtones.
Yeah, well, not really before exactly. Before I did music full-time, my last day job was at a company that made ringtones called Moderati. And they, I made pop songs into little MIDI ringtones for cute little cell phones.
So the pre-smartphone.
Pre-smartphones, exactly. And when smartphones started to take over, people didn't need cute little MIDI ringtones anymore. And the company kind of shunted me over to iPhone app project management, which was not a good fit for me. Because I didn't, I like to make things and not tell people what to do. So, who aren't going to listen to me anyway, because I'm not actually their boss. So that was no good. And the music was doing well. So I've been doing that full time.
So that was the last job you had before you went to music full time.
Yes. I've done almost nothing for money except music since I left that job.
So do you find that there's any similarities between sort of what you were creating that? I mean, did that give you any skills that you took with you?
Absolutely. When you have a really limited palette to make something sound like something else, you only have a tenor sax sound to make sound like vocals. Mm-hmm. you only have an FM synthesis piano and some drums. to make this rap song sound like a rap song on someone's tiny cell phone. It really is a great music production practice.
So did people give you feedback on that, like when you were working on that?
My coworkers did. I you know, we never heard from customers, oh, this didn't sound like that song, because people just are going to accept it. But we still wanted to do as good a job as we could with the songs, and taking pride in making a adorable MIDI ringtone was one of the joys of that job.
So was there anything like any of those ringtones that you did that you were like, this is the one, I got it. Like, this is like, it really captured the song in some weird way.
I wanted to give myself a ringtone Grammy for,
what would the ringtone Grammy look like? I guess.
I don't know. I guess like a cell phone probably. But, there's this technology called SMAF that Yamaha did, and it was mostly FM synthesis, but you had actually control over the sounds, and it had a little bit of PCM, a little bit of sample based synthesis. And there was a song by this band called Board Bangers that sampled, in the chorus, it sampled the ad from Meow Mix. Meow, 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 meow. And we happened to have a meow sample on the thing, so I made a ringtone for these adorable little phones that had a little meow sound on it, and I feel like I just nailed it.
You nailed it. That was the
nailed
best
it
one.
So hard.
But it was like, you had a piece of content there that you could use to make the ringtone that worked.
Yeah, and I had this tiny bit of extra sound that I could make into the thing that they sampled. That was this thing that we sampled. It was brilliant.
So did you call them up and say, like, I made this amazing thing?
You know what?
Did you get that sense of accomplishment?
I may have never recorded a phone playing that song, and it's one of my great regrets in life.
that was the pinnacle, the top of the heap.
Yeah.
So one thing I wanted to talk to you about a bit, and I think that would be relevant, is the fact that you've done how many Kickstarters now?
Seven.
Seven Kickstarters, and all of them successfully funded.
Yeah.
And for each of those, you did a video that goes along with those, no?
No, actually, the last two, I did not do a video. The reason I didn't do a video is if you post a link to a Kickstarter page on Facebook and it has a video, clicking on that plays the video instead of taking you to the page. If you don't include a video, you actually have less clicks to pledge than if you do include a video.
Oh, because of the way
it interacts with Facebook. So there's actually a reason not to put a video on Kickstarter. You can make a Kickstarter pitch video and put it on YouTube and then embed it in your Kickstarter page, and that's smarter than making a video and putting it on a Kickstarter.
So tell me about the first Kickstarter that you did, and like what you were shooting for and what it was about.
My first Kickstarter was for my album Casualties, and it was at the end of 2009, beginning of 2010, that I put this up. And my friends from Strummel Architecture had done a Kickstarter before.
Is that a band?
Yes, they're a Marin-based band that I used to play with. They're really, really good. Used to be called Halloo. Great band. They did Bandcamp before I did Bandcamp. They did Kickstarter before I did Kickstarter. It worked really well for them.
And Bandcamp was... Can you explain Bandcamp a little
bit? Oh, sure. Bandcamp is the platform that makes it easy for artists to sell directly to fans, downloads or CDs or whatever.
And people pay. It does a whole sort of... It does the transactional stuff.
Yeah, it takes it through PayPal for you. It does everything for you, except mailing the actual CDs, which you do yourself. But it was... very much needed in 2009 because, you know, if you had coder friends, you could make your coder friends, you could ask your coder friends to, you could ask your coder friends to make you something that would sell downloads for you. But there wasn't like a service that just did it for you until Bandcamp really easily.
Okay. So you were doing Bandcamp.
Yeah. And then my friends did a Kickstarter, and then I was like, okay, well, I guess I'll do a Kickstarter for just like $1,000 or $2,000 for this album. Just... to see how it goes, and I'll put song poems on there. I just watched this documentary on song poems called, I think it was called Off the Charts. It was a, I think, PBS documentary on this phenomenon in the 60s and 70s where people would pay money to studio musicians to record their poem as a song. And there was these promises of it'll be a number one hit because we'll record it and we'll send you a little record that we pressed of your song. And of course, none of them ever became hits at all. And so I did a bunch of song poems for rewards, and those were popular. And
so those are the rewards that were. And how are you delivering those?
Well, someone would send me lyrics, and a few months later, I would send them a song.
Okay.
And actually, a couple of them are on the City single that people pledged for. Those are, like, fully produced songs that are other people's words. So that was one of the rewards, and that was kind of an experiment to see who was going to pay $300 for this thing. And it turns out 6 people. And that was most of the money, and then a lot of people pre-ordered the CD as well. And I actually hit my funding goal basically the minute that I was giving notice at my job, just coincidentally. And then...
How long did it take you to hit the funding? Well, your funding goal was like $3,000, you said?
It was something small like that, yeah. I mean, I don't know. It took a few weeks.
Okay.
And then my next ones were more successful more immediately because I had that track record.
So how many... So when you were doing the first one, how did you connect with your existing fan base to, like, I mean, were you nervous? Were you, like, not sure you were going to make it? Or you knew that you had enough people? I mean, you had a mailing list? Or what was it that you went out to, like, folks to do?
I felt like I could definitely do it. It was kind of a conservative number. I already had started to tap into the steampunk community for fandomness. And I had a mailing list of like 2,000 people, and you know, maybe 1,000 of them actually check their email, or it doesn't bounce at least. And I had the Twitter and the Facebook, and obviously I have a lot more since then. But I was doing Ustream shows too at that point, and at that same time, actually, I got the Amanda Palmer bump for the first time, because I was doing a Ustream show, and she happened to see it and tweeted about it like 5 times. So that was helpful too. But even without her bump, I would have made that Kickstarter.
Right, I forgot about the man. And she, I mean, because you sort of have been, while she's been doing all her sort of meta big stuff, you've been sort of doing your own, I mean, smaller version of what.
Oh yeah, I've been trucking along. I mean, she's been, you know, monumentally more successful and more full time music than me. But yeah.
And what do you think? Like, what do you think are the fundamentals of that? Because I mean, one reason I wanted to talk to you is because, I mean, I think in this context of design, like more than almost anyone, I mean, you've really never been afraid to jump into the internet. I mean, it's never been an issue for you in terms of marketing, in terms of sales, in terms of all that stuff. I mean, it's like that's sort of been you've been swimming in that water from the moment you went. You've never worried about the death of the CD industry or something like that.
Never, never. I was on MP3.com back in 2000 when it was still an indie market. And that was where I got. I mean, I still have fans that I made from that time. And my first page was this Erica Mulkey. I hadn't chosen Unwoman yet. And you know, that was how I connected with other artists. I relished the death of the CD at that point. I thought this is the democratization of whatever, and we can share things with people. I mean, the thing that I. When I first started studying music production when I was in high school, the thing that I dreamed about was having my recorded songs played on the radio. And I get played in college radio now occasionally, but internet radio and just streaming is the thing that is actually accessible to people who are just starting out.
I mean, do you feel like you came in at a time... I mean, these days it seems like the opportunities are consistent, right? The market is just changing constantly, and if you don't wake up every day and jump on the next opportunity or think that you're going to do what you did last time, you're going to miss out.
Yeah, I mean, I constantly feel like I'm a step behind, and then I have a lot of friends who think that I'm a step ahead, but I definitely feel like there's catch up that I'm like, I have to aggressively look for, you know, new things, and I should be doing better than I am at that.
Because you've been, I mean, well, so you used your first Kickstarter in 2009.
Yeah.
And you've done 7 in 4 years.
Yeah.
So what's the formula for a successful Kickstarter for you? I mean, when do you know it's something that you want to take to Kickstarter? Like after you did the first one, what did you have a lesson out of that that you said, okay, this is how I'm going to do it from now on?
Yeah. I mean, I did another thing pretty shortly thereafter. I did a remix album of that same, mostly that same album. And I did a small run of that, so I didn't ask for very much money. I mean, I think the key for me is to respect the people who are going to be pledging, ask for reasonable amounts of money, and give them good value for what they pledge. So people who want to spend, you know, a few hundred dollars will get to have dinner with me, or I'll write a song for them, or I'll play a concert in their home, and it's really worth it. The people who pledge for some of the album, for the original albums, the people who pledge a dollar get the whole download, which is, I mean, you can't argue with that value.
Right, right.
And then the covers albums, because of licensing, I usually ask for more like $3 or $5 for those. But still, it's a good value. So I think the key is to not be taking advantage of anyone when you ask for money, because you like, they're doing you a favor and you're doing them a favor too if you do it right. It's mutual.
So the way you're building, right, because I always describe Kickstarter as having doing three things well, which is, first is marketing,
mm-hmm.
right? Second is proof of concept, right? If you don't get funded, you've done something wrong.
Right.
And you've never had that happen, right? You've gotten all your projects funded.
Yeah. And at some point I might do a more experimental project where I say, well, if you give me this much money, I'll do this thing. And it's a thing that I wouldn't necessarily do. Like, I'll write songs and I'll cover songs no matter what, because it's a thing that I feel compelled to do. But I don't know, I can't think of exactly what it would be, but some weird project that maybe a lot of people would want to put in $30,000 for that would, you know, feed me for a year, that I would do instead of doing other things. But if it didn't get funded, I would say, cool, because I'm not going to do it. So it can be used that way too, intentionally, but then a lot of people, you know, just ask for too much money and then get sad, or they don't understand that, you know, okay, that idea just doesn't work. Like, do something else.
Did you see, I saw one somebody posted as being very sad, which is
Kid and Play. I knew you were going to say it. They must have kept it secret. They must have tried to keep it secret, because for them to only raise $250.
Right. What were they
was
looking
ridiculous.
For? Something like 1.5 million or something.
No, it wasn't that much. They were only asking for like 20,000 or 200,000 or something, like, which they totally could have gotten.
So you think that they just, I mean, it was a spectacular script.
Listen, if they had sent it to anyone, I would have seen it. If anyone had seen it, it would have gone viral, and I would have seen it. And I didn't see it, and none of my friends saw it until afterwards, you know?
Because there's a flip, right? I mean, you're building celebrity through Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another side, which is taking advantage of celebrity through Kickstarter.
Right.
And I think... And then there's sort of the middle ground with Amanda Palmer and some of those folks who are sort of doing both simultaneously, right? Testing the waters for what they've done and going to where they're going.
I mean, it's simultaneous for everyone in a way, because, yeah, okay, so I'm leveraging my, you know, my 100 fans, and I'm getting more... I'm
you
getting
have more
exposure.
Than 100 fans.
Well, okay, but I'm getting exposure through my fan base and through their, you know, the friends of friends, too. And the same thing is true for people of any scale, honestly. Like, you have to connect to the people who already know who you are, and just by doing Kickstarter and saying, hey, I need money for this thing, your fans will spread it along to their friends, and it'll grow fan bases of even people who are hugely successful, I think.
Well, there was the thing that Amanda was doing talking to Morrissey, right, saying, like, you don't realize the power of what you have here.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if anybody... I don't know if he picked up on that or took care of it.
I mean, bless her for trying to talk to Morrissey.
Right? It's like it's almost like consulting, right?
Yeah.
It's like I have this skill. You know, the thing that's interesting about Kickstarter is there's a lot of people trying to do iPhone games and trying to do other technology stuff on there. And interestingly, iPhone games don't seem to be working as well, I think, because it's just really hard to give somebody virtual value.
Yeah, there are a lot of games already, and you have to actually prove that something is something unique. If you can get a political angle to it, you know, people will be really supportive of it. Feminism is really hot. And I'm pleased by this, obviously. You know, if there's a point to what you're doing, not just I'm making another game, then obviously, you know, you can get the message spread.
I mean, I wonder if part of it isn't that when you... The value of the Kickstarter is often about that sense of genuine connection with somebody that you've never actually met or never actually connected with. And music is very personal, right?
Yeah.
It's you singing at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Whereas an iPhone game, even a board game, is like, there's that sense of craftsmanship or something being made. Whereas maybe with software, the problem is it's, you know, it's so distinct from the individual who's creating.
Yeah, so the individual creator or the group, you know, creator that is identifiable has some type of celebrity, even if it's not like... you know, super popular mainstream celebrity, but some type of personality behind it, that's going to make something a lot more successful than just another game. And obviously, if you can present your game really well and you have a history of success, I mean, dangerous things can happen when someone says, hey, I'm going to make this game, and has never actually made a game before. That can get people into trouble.
Right, I mean, because there's not a lot of... I talk to people a lot about the idea that games, the fundamental problem, really with any really interactive experience, is that you're building the camera every time.
Yes.
Right? If you're creating an interactive experience, the thing that people want is the experience that they've never had before. Whereas for you, I mean, you know you can make the album. Push comes to shove. You're gonna break out the electric cello and the recording equipment, and you know that it's gonna happen.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, I mean, I've made a lot of albums at this point, and it's really straightforward, and it's just, I'm only relying on myself. And I've been a little bit late on some rewards, and nobody's minded, except for somebody's crazy ex-girlfriend, which...
well, okay, if it's that personal. But again, it's interesting, right? Because if it's somebody's crazy ex-girlfriend, it's about sort of trying to strengthen that relationship with you.
And
maybe not in a positive way.
Right. No, well, it was more like demanding her money back because I was late on my vinyl. Cool, you can have it. So the track record is important. Knowing that you can do it is important. I know some musicians who are working with a lot of collaborators who are late on things because there's just a lot of other factors there you can't rely on.
So you're saying that musicians are sometimes unreliable in terms of delivering?
Yeah, who would have thought?
I never heard that before, but it's nice. It's the first time on this podcast. That's excellent.
Well, I'm really, really sorry to finally, you know, reveal the truth about musicians.
And artists in general, right?
Artists in general, yeah.
They don't always deliver. So one thing that makes me think of, because, you know, I recently had the experience, so I'll tell everyone, I funded your last Kickstarter, which was...
Thank you.
You're welcome. Because there was a song I wanted you to sing, which was Goodbye Horses, which, you know, is maybe not quite as creepy as it sounds. Who knows? And the song from Silence of the Lambs. But you not only recorded that song, but then I got to see you perform it live, like, just a few days ago. And I loved... I mean, for me, it was great to have that moment of transition from something that... I wanted you to hear you sing it, because I really thought it would... I just loved the idea of it. And then to have you sing it and put it on the record, and then to actually get to see you perform it, right? And it was a really personal journey for me. And, you know, that cost me, what was it, $100?
Yeah, $100.
Right, exactly. Yeah. To have that personal experience. And that was awesome for me as a fan, but also awesome for me as someone who creates software, right? Or creates experiences for people.
Yeah.
Right? And so you have that whole live part.
Yeah. I will say your case was kind of special.
Because we knew each other.
Well, partly because we're friends, and partly because that was such a good song choice.
This is what I do, hopefully.
Well, you know, you made a very good choice. There have been people, like a lot of people who pay for song poems. You know, I will write a song based on your poem and I'll record it, but to ask me to play it live is very unlikely to happen because there's, it's not going to ever quite be in my head as much as something that I wrote. The same thing is true for a cover request. It would normally be true for a cover request, except that song was so good that it did get in my head. And not to say that people's poems aren't really good, and sometimes they will be, but, like, they're not mine, and I don't know, it's just...
There's just a lot of layers, and you don't know what's going to hit
I don't know what's going to resonate with me enough to be that, and so I think you got extra good value for your $100 that
sure.
Many people do not.
And look, I didn't know that was going to happen.
Right.
But the possibility of it, and that... The personal of it is an exciting thing.
Cool. Yeah.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, pushing farther into that, the difference between recorded material and live material, and then sort of blurring the... do you think Kickstarter blurs the lines a little bit between the recorded experience and the live experience?
In terms of interactivity and communication.
And relationship. Yeah.
Relationship, yeah. I mean, Kickstarter you know, Kickstarter and Twitter and Facebook and people's blogs and all that. Those are all parts of it. Kickstarter definitely gives people kind of a behind the scenes, you know, a backstage pass to a creative process.
How many updates do you think you give over the course of a Kickstarter?
Not enough. I'm way over, the Lemniscate ones. I really should have sent one out before Thursday's show, and I just didn't do it. And I need to send
saying to come to the show.
Yeah, and I need to send one out saying you should have all gotten your stuff, and I haven't done it. But when I'm actually making something, I send one every couple weeks.
During the course of it, right?
Yeah, while it's running and after it's finished and I'm recording or whatever, I do try to keep people up to date.
And then do you feel like you're bringing people, like, do people show up for each Kickstarter and you sort of bring them into the Unwoman fan community?
I think so. I think, you know, not everybody who pledged to my penultimate one pledged to this last one, but a lot of them
fires
did.
Fires I
Started, yeah.
Right.
That one raised $23,000 and this last one raised over $14,000. So not as much, but I also didn't ask for as much. Because I wasn't trying to do vinyl. Ugh. I'm never doing vinyl again, by the way.
Really? I mean, so did you see that there's a... there's a company that does vinyl now. That, like, basically will take... Like, it's like Audible for vinyl. It takes your... Like, they'll do the vinyl for you, and they'll do vinyl on demand. So it's even though it's...
Oh, vinyl on demand. Okay, that's my solution from now on. Anyone who wants vinyl has to go to the... Yeah.
Vinyl on demand, guys. I'll put it in the show notes, and I'll send you a copy.
Yeah, okay, please do.
So, because I think that's... You know, I was at Maker Faire last week,
mm-hmm.
and I thought a lot about your career and the way that you do stuff, and that there's a physicality. I mean, whether it's vinyl, you know, vinyl's nice and it's physical and it's analog and all those lovely things. But at the same time, you know, when you go to one of your shows, you're very personal. Like, you don't put a lot of distance between yourself and the audience, or sort of have some expectation, right?
Yeah, no. People come up to me at the merch table. I talk to everyone who wants to talk to me.
And I think that's a big part of sort of being a musician in the modern age.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have to get comfortable with that, or was that sort of your thing right out of the gate?
I mean, you know, my first shows I played, I think, for, you know, 10 to 30 people.
And so that killed off a lot of the rock star dreams early on?
Or? It did. It absolutely did. Yes, I had rock star dreams right out of college. I was a full-time musician for the first year out of college. I didn't make any money, but I was a full-time musician. It was basically just before.
And
I
you got you, your degree was in music, yeah?
Yes.
And I'm going to get this wrong, but you'll correct me. It's electronic music.
I majored in music and minored in electronic music.
So tell me about what's an electronic music minor that's different than a music major?
I had to take one programming class and a lot of electronic music classes and, like, physics of music. That was the only extra requirements.
Okay. So
and they were all very easy for me.
So it wasn't about sort of getting into the modern post Napster world of music or something.
No, it was not at all about music marketing. It was all about the actual making of the music. We didn't study, you know, that stuff was all ours to figure out on our own. The internet.
So it seems like it's impossible now to have a career in music without understanding how to do that stuff. To how to understand the internet part. I mean, it seems almost like a disservice to people coming out of... I mean, maybe now that's part of it. I mean, how do you feel about that? The integration of music marketing as part of of a music career.
Do English majors have to take classes on how to shop their novel?
No.
How to get agents?
They should, though,
They
right?
should, but they don't. But the same thing is probably true about the electronic music minor.
I mean, a lot of the complaints that I hear about modern marketing, and I hear it, you know, in interactive media, right? The big part for me is that as I write about the industry now and think about the changes in interactive entertainment generally, it's the same problem, right? People have been sheltered. Like, there's a $60 fee to play a game, and then once that bridge is crossed, you never have to pay again. I mean, there's horse armor or whatever, the in-game
mm-hmm.
add-ons, but
mm-hmm.
And so people have this attitude, like, still, that I'm separate from the marketing. Those marketing people will go and do that for me.
Mm.
And you've never had that luxury, right?
No,
I mean,
not at
you
all.
Have to go and I mean, certainly, I mean, Dylan probably didn't have to go out and try to find fans, right? He had a music label for that. I mean, do you miss that? Do you want that? Is it something that, or did you think about it, or it just happened so fast you never even
I have sent my material to a grand total of 3 record labels in my life. And all of them were, like, niche, independent, you know, gothy, whatever labels. And none of them wanted me, and that was cool. So I'm not gonna lie. I constantly fantasize about a day where all I have to do is wake up and produce music and or play shows. And I don't have to send emails. I don't have to, you know, to keep up with contracts and try to, you know, pimp myself to bookers and write to conventions all the time. And I dream of the day when someone will let me pay them to be my publicist and actually send my music to actual blogs. That would be really amazing for me. But so as everyone that I've worked with in those capacities has not been worth anything at all. They've been complete imposters. So, I mean, it would be great to be on a label and have someone else do that for me.
Are you ready to switch out of that world at a moment's notice?
I am, but I also know that this has gotten me really far. It's been hard work, and I'm really, really proud of the work that I've done. So I think I wouldn't have known that I could come this far without a label. If I had asked, if like you had asked me 12 years ago, I would have thought, oh, of course I have to be on a label. You know?
But the world's been tilting your way as well.
Yeah, ever since. I mean, even like back on MP3.com, that was the beginning of getting your music really out to people. And I seeded my Napster folders with my own stuff, and people listened to it there too. And
okay.
Back in the day
when Napster was the thing.
Whenever was the thing.
When we were all listening to half songs because we didn't download them properly.
Yes. And the artist names were spelled wrong, but we knew it was really George Michael. And, it was good times. So even starting back then, it was like the record labels were becoming less and less necessary, but I still thought that someone would want me. And I fantasized also, honestly, about a producer telling me what to do and me not having to produce my own stuff and someone saying, you need to sound like this. And it's
being put through that machine that people used to be put through, right? That turned them from whatever they were to whatever they become.
Yeah. And I kind of, I half of me resisted that as a feminist, you know, female artist. Half of me was like, I'm going to be self-produced forever and control my own image and all these things. And half of me was like, God, ain't nobody got time for that. and here I am, and I've done everything myself all along. And a few years ago, a guy who's not any more successful than I am, who is a music producer, told me that I needed to work with a producer, and I basically got to say, I'm holding up middle finger. I don't know. Can I swear on this podcast?
I
got to say, screw you, buddy. I can produce my own music. And if it's flawed, it's flawed. But it's me doing it. So, yeah, there have been times when I wanted someone else to do those things for me. But I'm kind of happy not with it.
You have this skill set that you've built up now.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, I guess there's a sense of loss in that you didn't get to dive purely into the music, but then there's sort of a skill set that you've built up over time.
But then it's like, how much more prolific could I possibly be? Does anybody want to buy more than one original album from me a year? Like, does anybody really want to buy more albums from me than I'm making? Probably not.
Right.
I have 17 hours of music on the USB drives that I sell.
That you've produced over a
decade. That
I've produced
over the course of over a decade, yeah. But, yeah.
I mean, there's that weird thing I always think about where artists sort of bands start out hungry, right? They start out with music, an album a year, and then if they're on a big label, it's like once every 3 years, and then suddenly it's that 5-year event.
And then you're Kate Bush, and it's 10 years because you had a kid, and I mean,
but
yeah.
But then she went back and built a studio for herself.
And I still love her very much.
Right.
But
I'm not sure about the washing machine focus. But
yeah, I'm not into that. Yeah.
And the last album was and the covers of her own stuff.
Yeah, that was. I don't want to listen.
We can.
I don't want to trash Kate Bush because I love her too much.
No. And the thing about Kate Bush is she has no worries about us, right? Like she is a
yes.
She's become an icon in England, which
yes.
is what you want to be, right?
Yes.
Which is that she can put out her laundry list almost literally and
sing a song about the washing machine for
right.
that laundry list.
And it's brilliant, right? Because she's, I mean, pop music in England is so much more integrated into woven into the fabric of culture than I think that's been my.
I think you're right. I think you're right.
So I'm not. I don't worry about her. We won't hurt her career. But the point being.
No.
But she did go. I mean, she went indie in a lot of ways, right? I mean, I think she built her own label and she built her own studio in the back of her house and whatever.
Yeah.
Leeds or Curry or Summerson or whatever British sounding place she lovely British sounding place she lives. It probably has 5 beautiful days a year. And. But it's, I mean, that's, so what's your direction? What are you building towards? What are your next milestones in terms of what you want? I mean, you've sort of figured out Kickstarter to the degree that you know where you can get, and you're getting, and you've got the steampunk shows, right? How many shows a year would you say you do through the steampunk community?
15.
So 15 shows.
Oh, I mean more. If you only count conventions, like 12 to 15.
Okay.
Including the sci-fi cons with the steampunk track. In terms of just, like, you know, nightclub shows, probably a few more.
So many shows a year do you do just to sort of round that out?
I could look at a spreadsheet and tell you off the top of my head, like,
guess.
70.
70 a year. I thought a lot higher percentage would have been the steampunk.
Well, I guess most of them are steampunk. But, yeah, I guess if you're counting, like, I don't.
Okay, we don't have to have a firm answer.
I'm too anal about numbers to tell you the wrong number without looking at my spreadsheets. But I'm going to open my laptop right now.
All right, I'm going to pause for a second.
Okay.
So we just had a pause where Erica popped open her MacBook and went through her spreadsheets to look up how many shows she did last year. So
I did about 40 shows. I said 13? 12?
Yeah, 13.
13 of them were steampunk conventions.
Okay, and so that's been, and that's the only conventions that you play are steampunk.
Mostly steampunk. I'll do sci-fi with the steampunk track also.
Okay, so that's been a pretty good source of both fans and work for you over the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's been terrific, and I want to keep doing it. But you asked me what was next for me. There are two things that are milestones that I really need to get to the next level. One of them is. Song placement in a TV show.
Right, we were talking because when we went on a steampunk cruise together.
Yes.
And there's a band called Abney Park.
Yes.
And they got a song onto True Blood.
True Blood, yeah.
And that was a huge, huge thing for them, yeah?
Totally, absolutely, yeah, it was great.
So what are you looking for? Canadian sci-fi shows?
sure, whatever, honestly. Anything that wants me that's appropriate. I'll do it, and you know, there's some money involved and a lot of promotion involved, and I need those things.
Do you know people besides Captain Robert who's made that work, or what the plan and how you get to that is?
I know a few people, and they've worked with people, and I need to get, you know, in touch with those people.
So it's a networking thing.
It's a networking thing, yeah. I don't have anyone representing me in that now, and I have some friends that I need to hit up to try to really push that. It's kind of a case where I have to, like, say, I am ready for this, I want it, and I'm going to ask for it really hard until I get it. And I think I can get it. I mean, I'm privileged enough by the various, you know, vicissitudes of fate that I feel like I can do that with almost anything I set my mind to. So,
you know, I just want to point out, too, because as... You know, the music industry's gone through such huge changes. And really, a lot of that happened just really right before you started, right? Because you'd say your career started right around 2000.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, we'd gone through Napster and all the, and the world of the, of, you know, the world of music as it had been sort of ended, right?
Yes.
And so you've completely been in the new model. And I think for a lot of people who've been in other industries that haven't been as shattered, to understand how much you have to get out there and hustle for what you want. Right, to make it happen, I think it can be an eye opener. I mean, because you've never stopped hustling for what you want.
Right? Yeah, that's true. It's true.
So the next steps for you are to go out there and find an agent or figure out the pathway to get the music onto television.
Yes, that is one of the things. The other thing, and both of these things will help with each other. The other thing is to open for a major band on a tour, and to travel with them and to play for people, to play for new audiences. There are a lot of you know, bands that are kind of similar to what I'm doing who are really successful.
Go ahead and name a few. So people know what they're listening to and I'll make sure that there's plenty of ways to go.
So they're not terribly successful, but I listen to a lot of Florence and the Machine, a lot of Lana Del Rey, on a totally different side of things, I listen to a lot of Nico Case. And there are these artists that, and there are other people who sound more like me who are also successful. Anyway, if I could open for them and be exposed to their fans, that would be a whole nother level up for me. And I'm willing to pay money to be on those tours. I know, like, musicians like to think that the public needs to be sheltered from the fact that people are paying money to be openers for
tours. Is that
true?
Is that happening?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Everyone,
wow.
Like, people are buying on. Anytime you see a band, especially kind of a crummy band of young hopeful musicians with stars in their eyes opening for a band that's really successful, and you're like, who is this? They paid money to be on that tour. And I'm willing to pay money to be on a tour because I think it would be worth it.
Okay. So, I mean, but at a certain point, right, if a band's super successful, that doesn't happen. I mean, like, the National isn't, again, to go back to them, is not probably having a paid opening band, or really those slots?
A lot of bands are too cool to do that.
Right.
Yes. They will prefer editorial approval over cold hard cash.
I mean, the two bands I can think of off the top of my head that that I saw over the last 2 years that have really moved from one level to another was Y-Oak, who opened for the National at the Bill Graham with, like, basically 20 people, you know, 50 people in there filtering in early enough.
Yeah.
But then they, you know, but then the Noise Pop Festival the next year, they were headliners.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So that works.
Yeah, well, like, bands like, I don't know how Geographer did it. But they opened for my, you know, for Stromal Architecture when I was playing with them a few years ago, and now I hear them in Forever 21, and I'm like, yes,
yeah,
and they're awesome, and they have electric cello too,
right?
And actually, and they're one of the bands that I should definitely write to and be like, hey guys, remember me from Café du Nord?
And they're a San Francisco band.
They are
very deeply San Francisco.
Yes, and they're super amazing too. So there's bands that are like that they probably did it by opening for someone bigger, or I don't know, they did things right.
So let's talk merch real quick.
Sure.
Since we're sort of heading in towards the final end of the interview.
Cool.
You've built you've done everything from matchbooks to vinyl to CDs to you have a complete collection of your albums available with a crystal Unwoman.
Yep, the crystal and brushed steel
USB.
Be-logoed light up Unwoman USB.
And how many USB versions? That's the third version of it?
Ooh,
that?
No. Let's see. The first one was just little generic slot music drives that acquired from marketing campaign that I just loaded with stuff, and they were just 1 gig, and I just loaded them with stuff, and I tied them with a pink ribbon to antique keys, and I sold them at SteamCon. The steampunks went crazy for them. That was the first thing. The second thing was shaped like a bullet, and it was red, and it looked like a vibrator. Those were very popular. Those were 2 gig, and I released those with Casualties, which was like my fourth album and my first Kickstarter album.
Okay.
And
was that like one of the Kickstarter tiers, or?
I'm pretty sure it was. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. Yeah.
So that was sort of like bringing everything together.
Yeah. And then the next one was the gold USB, and those were like adorable, cute little micro USBs that were really solid metal. They looked like gold. And then there was the dark metal USB. And those are almost sold out. I actually have a few copies of that left. And then this last one. So that's what, this is what, the fifth?
Okay.
So the crystal one is the fifth, and I brought these out for the Lemniscate Kickstarter.
And how have those been selling? How have people been?
Great. And I had both options for sale at Steampunk World's Fair last weekend, and people chose the crystal one, which actually surprised me because the small one is so convenient. But the crystal one is like a significant, like, it's like an artsy paperweight almost, so.
Right, I mean, it goes back to being, it has your symbol on it. I mean, there's no, the one before, I think I saw, right, it's much, much smaller.
Yeah, it's very small. It does have the symbol.
Okay.
But it doesn't have the name, the Ambigram logo, it just has the symbol.
Right, so you'll sell those out when you don't have any other ones to sell.
Well, I'll sell, the black ones will sell eventually, I think, but the crystal ones are really popular.
And have you added Lemniscate to the?
Yes, and so the copies of the black ones that I'm selling do have Lemniscate on it.
Yeah, Lemniscate. I gotta say that right. Did I say Lemniscate?
It's okay.
Tell me what that word means really quick.
Lemniscate is the symbol for infinity.
Oh, okay. Okay. Right. I'm drawing the infinity symbol in the
right. So with looping music, it's just because of the loop basedness of that album.
So how do you feel merch ties into everything else that you do? Right? I mean, it's right. The merch table is your profit center at a lot of these
shows. Oh, yeah. Most of my money is made from merch sales. I don't, because I like to be accessible for steampunk conventions that are run on kind of tight budgets, I don't ask for a very big appearance fee. And to make it worth my while, I give people good suggestions as to how to feature me well to get my merch sold so that it's worth it for me to come to these. And it's and so it's great. Yeah, I make a lot of merch sales.
Because I've had a sort of a theory that, music at this point, it can't be about profiting on the music. Right? I mean, is that kind of off the beam? Or how? I mean, you've lived this, right? You've got merch, you've got Kickstarter, and you're selling CDs. I mean, where do you see the actual value of the music fitting in?
I mean, do you mean the music as the music itself?
Selling music.
I mean, a lot of people pledge for the downloads on the Kickstarter, which is, it is selling both the music and the being part of the process, I guess.
Because they really would, I mean, if they wanted it badly enough, they wouldn't have to pay you.
Well, sure, but they get to get it first if they pay me.
Right, they don't have to go searching for it. I mean, did you ever have that moment of like, erg, people are pirating my stuff?
Oh, sure. It was erg, but also, aw, they like me. They really like me. But I mean, they're still jerks. Like, the people on the Russian sites are still total jerk holes, and I hate them.
Who are actually, the one thing I should point out is those people charge money for access to the music.
Yes. So the people who share my music with their friends on mixtapes, I love them. Like, they're doing good things, and I do the same with music that I like. The people who have ad sites that have, you know, that have my music on them illegally, or are charging people money for music that I don't ever see, those people are the scum of the earth.
Right, because they're profiting.
Yeah.
And that's not sharing, and it's not giving you value for
It's not okay in any way.
Right. So there's different layers even of that.
Yeah.
So before we finish up, is there anything else like that you think, you know, from a design point, like from a point of view of interactive design, of your experience of like creating something for an audience or, you know, building something for a community that you're building for yourself that you could leave people with that you think would be helpful information for them to have, or something that you've hard won knowledge that you think that a lot that people could use, what would you say?
I think to listen to the people you're making things for, and I could do more of that myself, but everyone could probably do more of that. And that's, all of these internet tools make it really easy to do that. So there's really no excuse not to. And I mean, I have friends who have run Kickstarters for a project that they think everyone wants, and then they find out they don't want it. But it turns out, and then they try to run another one, and it's for almost the same thing. And it turns out that they're just not listening to what people actually want. So give the people what they want, you know?
And how do you hear that voice? I mean, how do you hear that from people? What do you tune into that lets you know that it's what they want?
I say, you say, like, I can do these two things. Which would you prefer? Because you're not going to say, I could be a baseball star. Would you like me to do that? And, like, let people tell you to be a baseball
star.
Unless
you're Michael Jordan in the 90s.
Yeah, and then you can really try, really just give it your all, you know?
Right.
Okay. But, you know, you have the skill set and you have a few options of things that will make you happy. One of them is going to be the thing that makes other people really happy, and the other one's going to be something that maybe only makes you happy. And so you have to ask people, hey, which would you prefer? And maybe you already know, and you know, maybe it's, I don't know. But just within your skill set and your interests, do what makes other people happy. There's nothing wrong with it.
Thanks very much for being on, Erica. I appreciate it. This has really been great.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's always great to talk with you.
And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of the Active Design Podcast. Thanks so much to Erica Mulkey/Unwoman for doing the interview. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Yacht for the opening music. And for the first time ever anywhere is a brand new recording of a song Erica has only performed live up until now, Beauty Over Industry, her steampunk anthem, which I think has a lot of relevance to the game design and interactive design community. So here it comes, enjoy, and we'll be back next week with a very special interview, the first of a two, possibly three-part interview that I have with Ken Levine, creative director of Irrational Games, writer and designer of the Bioshock and Bioshock Infinite. We're going to get into some really interesting conversations. Ken has been a friend of mine for a long, long time, and we've tried to take some of what we've been talking about for the last 30 years and wrapping it up into a podcast. So I hope that you'll listen. I hope that you'll tell your friends. I hope that it will be as exciting for you to listen to as it was for me to do. All right, until next time, goodbye.